From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On our show today, the Grammy Awards are just over a week away, and there's turmoil in the executive offices of the Recording Academy. Then the curator of a museum exhibition about Auschwitz, the largest of the Nazi death camps, explains the urgency of retelling stories about the Holocaust.
Many of the issues that were very current and that also in some way triggered the Holocaust in the 1930s and early 1940s are again present in our conversations.
And a TV and film fund that promotes diversity and inclusion gets new leadership. All that coming up on The Frame. Grammy President Deborah Dugan has been placed on administrative leave after only 5 months on the job. She's the first woman to lead the Recording Academy in its 63-year history. The Academy says Dugan's removal followed an allegation of workplace misconduct, but a lawyer for Dugan described something that sounds like a coup, saying she had complained about the Academy's governance. Michael Wood is the pop music critic for the LA Times. He profiled Dugan just a few days ago. Michael, thanks for coming back on the show.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So before we get into Dugan's removal, what was the climate that she was brought into at the Recording Academy?
So Deborah replaced Neil Portnow. He was there for 17 years, and I think generally well-regarded by many in the music industry, looked at by some as a bit old-fashioned. He made a lot of trouble for himself a couple of years ago when he was asked after the Grammys why so few women had performed on the show and won major awards. And he, in a sort of rambling response, said that women should step up, that was the word, if they wanted to be recognized at the Grammys. So caused an understandable controversy. Eventually, he leaves the job, and Dugan comes in.
What was her mandate? What was she asked to do? And what was the Recording Academy trying to do in terms of changing its image?
I've talked to people who said that she was brought in to be a change agent. That's what somebody said to me. Brought in to sort of fix some of the old boys' club problems that had been viewed as a part of the Recording Academy culture. She talked a lot about asking the right questions, looking at everything to see what might be changed and hasn't, just because it's sort of always been like that. Other people have said that her appetite for change was maybe a little bit greater than the board at the Academy. So I think the question of her mandate, that's sort of the one right now.
You profiled her just a couple of days ago in the LA Times. What did she say then her priorities were, and what struck you about the direction she was headed?
I was impressed by her optimism. You know, in my talks with her, I told her, look, this is to some degree a thankless job. Like, why do you want this? Portnow didn't go well for him at the end, and he just became sort of an emblem of dissatisfaction for a lot of people. And she said, look, why should this be a thankless job? You're getting to represent music makers and creative artists. This should be a great job. And so that struck me, that even among it all, she sort of found this to be something that was an opportunity. She also talked about, she used the phrase noble paradox, and she talked about how the Grammys should both celebrate innovation at the same time that they preserve tradition. And that's, you know, obviously that's a tricky job, because the Grammys have for years been looked at as sort of the museum of old music. In recent years, they've really tried to bring things up to speed, but, you know, within the more than 20,000 people in the Academy, you've got a lot of different constituencies. You've got the younger, new artists who want the Grammys to be cutting edge, and then you've got all the old folks who've been around forever and probably liked how things were going. And so you got to please both those masters.
We're talking with Michael Wood, the pop music critic at the LA Times, about the removal of Grammy CEO Deborah Dugan. The Recording Academy's Board of Trustees announced Thursday that Dugan is on immediate administrative leave. What do we know about the allegations and investigation?
Very little. I've talked to some people since that who can't imagine what this is referring to. I mean, allegations, misconduct, these are obviously super ominous words. I've also talked to people who said that maybe this was a push her out before she can push them out type situation. Somebody said that she had been asking questions about why there's so much infrastructure at the Recording Academy. So, you know, you can read the meaning between the lines there.
The board statement said the allegation was brought by, and I'm quoting now, a senior female member of the Recording Academy team. And it seemed odd to include the gender of the complainant, but Dugan's attorney said her removal was something different, calling it a coup. What is her lawyer saying about possible motivation for her ouster?
He's issued a statement that was pretty juicy, says that there will be much more to come in terms of exposing the real reasons why Dugan was ousted. And he also referred to Portnow's step-up comment, and he suggested that she was ousted because this is what happens when someone tries to step up, and sort of implied change the culture at an old-fashioned institution.
Her lawyer also referenced voting irregularities. What have been some of the complaints about how the Grammys are decided?
The way that I understand it, and different people have different views on this, the Grammys have what's called a Nominations Review Committee, also known as a secret committee, because nobody knows who's on it, and that extends to people who I am shocked don't know who's on it. And my understanding is that they sort of massage the nominations for the big categories. They kind of steer. Once those nominations are out in the public, my understanding is that the voting itself is clean. That's not really disputed. But that the nominations, who ends up being nominated for Album of the Year, Record of the Year, da-da-da. Now, what are they doing? It depends on who you ask. Some people think that they're trying to put up a field of nominees that kind of looks good. Somebody used the phrase woke. They want to present the sort of image of wokeness in who's nominated. Other people have told me that, you know, it's classic. You vote for my guy, I'll vote for your guy. Just classic backroom favor trading.
Michael Wood is the pop music critic for the LA Times, and he joined us for the latest on the removal of Grammy CEO Deborah Dugan. Michael, thanks for coming back on the show.
Of course. Thanks, John.
Coming up next on The Frame, Jojo Rabbit is a movie about Nazis and hate. A new museum exhibit reminds us the consequences. Taika Waititi is the director, screenwriter, and co-star of the Oscar-nominated Jojo Rabbit. He told me that he was motivated to make this movie about Nazis and World War II because history keeps repeating itself and people are quickly forgetting about the Holocaust.
So no, we haven't learned anything. That's the point in telling these stories. You have to keep telling these stories in order to keep teaching ourselves and to keep teaching younger audiences the difference between right and wrong and love and hate.
So how do we remember and teach history? Movies play a role, schools of course do, and so do museums. With Jojo Rabbit fresh in my mind, I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and on a cold and rainy morning, I decided to visit the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. That's from the audio guide for a massive exhibit now showing at the museum. It's called Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away.
This gallery includes two very different but connected objects, a large iron wheel set and nearby, a woman's stylish red shoe.
Like the scale of the Holocaust itself, the installation is overwhelming, including more than 700 original objects and 400 photographs. Robert Jan van Pelt is the chief curator of Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away, and he explained why telling the story of Auschwitz is so difficult.
In some way, the story of Auschwitz had never really been told. It's not even that well told in Auschwitz itself, because in some way the burden of that site, of the teachers at the site, the guides at the site, the museum is, that they have so much. You know, it's an enormous site. It is full of authentic artifacts of buildings, barbed wire, posts. I mean, there is an incredible amount of stuff, but it is, again, the very plenitude of that stuff that's there that makes it difficult to in some way tell a story in 2 hours that really has, I think, a great kind of emotional intensity and a kind of also intellectual punch. And what we were able to do, because in a sense we had to work with a limited number of artifacts and a limited a space available, limited budget, is that in some way we could create a story that is very well concentrated on a single idea, in a sense that a place like this existed, that it's possible for such a place to exist again because it has existed. But I think always the question of how we tell the story, how we plot the story, what do we leave out of the story in order for the story to become memorable, that is in some way almost like an artistic kind of act that we very much focused on to get that right.
Well, I think what you're talking about is the magnitude of the Holocaust and of Auschwitz is in some ways incomprehensible. And yet when you start to get little things, personal objects, I mean, some of the most moving things that I encountered at the exhibit were a letter, a young girl's dress, a child's shoe and a sock. And as a parent myself, knowing that my kids had shoes and socks that size, that it somehow becomes imaginable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that particular artifact, so it's a boy's shoe. It's a shoe for a boy of 2 or 3 years old. It's mint, it's repaired, so probably it's a hand-me-down. Very clearly, it was not a new shoe. And then the sock is still tucked in. So the story that we tell about the shoe is we forensically try to tease the story out of the shoe because we do not know whose shoe this was. It was found in Auschwitz in the undressing room after the gassing.
After selection, the child who wore this shoe would have walked, or was perhaps carried by his mother, to a large building where he was told to undress for a shower. The shoe and sock are caught in time. Was the sock put into the shoe gently by the child or his mother?
You can imagine the mother telling the boy, because mothers and children would be led first to the guest chambers in the undressing room, tuck your sock in the shoe because when you come back, you don't want to have lost your sock. And so what this particular artifact does, it's a moment in time. You can literally both hear the mother saying this, and you can also see that the boy has learned to do this when the boy maybe went, you know, to the beach to swim or something like that. And you can, again, in some way go back to that very moment, which, of course, is a moment in which the Germans, the SS at Auschwitz, told a lie to these people. You're going to the shower and you will come back and you will, you know, dress again and you will have your shoes again and you will get a good meal and, you know, you will work here and have a life. So many pieces come together in this one particular moment that boy tucked his sock in the shoe. And for us, it's a very dramatic artifact.
One of the things that was remarkable when I went and toured the exhibit is I looked out the window about halfway through, and the museum is very far south in Manhattan, and through this one window was perfectly framed the Statue of Liberty. And what it represented at the time and what it represents now in terms of our conflicted feelings about welcoming people who are fleeing war and fleeing oppression seems in so many ways to accentuate the experience of walking through this exhibit and being in this museum.
Yes, actually, the framed view of the Statue of Liberty happens in a room called Liberation. It is the room dedicated to the story of the liberation of Auschwitz in January 27th, 1945. And in that sense, of course, it refers to the basically the welcome after some years of not being that welcome in the late 1940s of many Jewish DPs into the United States. We also have a room that is dedicated to the expulsion of the Jews. And that's a room that basically deals with 1938 to 1939. And originally, we wanted to have a second view on the Statue of Liberty from that particular room, because that's where we tell the story of the St. Louis, a ship full of Jewish refugees that was refused admission into the United States and, for that matter, also Canada. And so what we tried originally to do is actually have two views on the Statue of Liberty. One is basically of the betrayal of the ideal that the statue represents, and the second time, the affirmation. But architecturally, it didn't work, so the room dedicated to the expulsion of the Jews ended up on the north side of the building.
We're talking with Robert Jan van Pelt, who's the chief curator of Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away. Tell me about why the exhibit is called that and what those additional words have to say about the exhibit's importance.
Now, I think that, first of all, the name, of course, is there's some kind of reference to Star Wars there. And, you know, if you can mobilize a happy memory of an experience that everyone enjoyed, I think it's always useful. But more importantly, I think that today the way that Holocaust education and also presentations of the story of the Holocaust, that we have to start to conceptualize it, is that while anti-Semitism and it was clearly 30, 40 years ago when the great Holocaust museums were planned and designed, something that was considered to be of the past in the Western world, today it's current. And in addition, of course, we have major crisis all over the world with refugees who are not being given asylum. I mean, there's a situation in the Mediterranean, Syria, Jordan, but also the situation in North America, the Mexican United States border. And so many of the issues that were very current and that also in some way triggered the Holocaust in the 1930s and early 1940s are again, present in our political and also social and economic kind of conversation. So in that sense, we believe it is a current topic, and therefore we called it Auschwitz not long ago, not far away.
About a year and a half ago, the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany released a poll, and it said 2/3 of American millennials cannot identify what Auschwitz is, and 22% of millennials said they haven't heard of the Holocaust or are not sure whether they've heard of it. What is the importance of your show, any piece of art about the Holocaust, given those terrifying numbers?
Ultimately, you know, an exhibition will be visited by, you know, 400, 500, 600,000 people. And that is actually a very small part of the general population. But if it helps to motivate the people who are on the front line of, in some way, holding back that wave of barbarism that's coming to us. I mean, every Hannah Arendt, a famous philosopher, once said, you know, every new generation, if it's not educated, are basically potential barbarians, if not savages. But the front line in it are the teachers. And so I am very much in the way that we conceived of the exhibition. You know, if we can speak to the teachers, if in some way we can motivate them, and that's not only, of course, school teachers, also the parents. Yeah, it is about getting a conversation between the parents and the children, a conversation between teachers and their pupils.
Robert Jan van Pelt is the chief curator of Auschwitz, Not Long Ago, Not Far Away. It's on view through August 30th at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much.
Up next on The Frame, a fund for TV and film projects that support diversity and inclusion has a new leader. Effie Brown is a veteran Hollywood producer. Her credits include Dear White People and Real Women Have Curves. But now she has a new title, CEO of Game Changer. It was founded in 2013 as the first film financing fund by and for women. And a large number of the fund's investors are women of color. Effie has long championed diversity and inclusion efforts in entertainment, and she sees this new role as a continuation of that past work.
One of the things that I really felt is like, you know what? We all rise together. Like, I felt that, you know, right now there's been, as you know, a big push for like inclusivity and diversity, but people are getting siloed into like women or people of color or LGBTQ and all of these things. And I'm like, that's how we become like crabs in a barrel. That's where we become competitive. But all of us need to rise up together. All of our voices have a place and need a place to be heard. Do you know what I'm saying? So for me, for Game Changer, that's what we do.
There are so many obstacles to representation in entertainment. There are the people who are making the decisions. There's access to capital. But when you start to look at where the cracks might be, where you can make an entry, where would you define that?
We typically have always had a problem in regard to access and resources. I'll say the few years ago, but before everybody with the lips of diversity and inclusion on everybody's lips, we had to get in where we could. And we were sometimes used, as I call it, tools, right? You know, we told our stories, but we weren't necessarily the ones producing it. Certainly weren't the ones directing it. And we absolutely weren't the ones who were going to be making the most profit from it. So one of the things that I feel really strongly about is, all right, look, you know, the diversity of our content needs to be as diverse as our financing and our investors, because we, and I'm just going to put it out there, we have to have skin in the game as well. And then by us having skin in the game, and I'm talking financially, that gives us more leverage when we build our strategic partnerships. I'm coming with something in hand. We want to be at the table, and we also want to be able to participate financially in ownership and in perpetuity. Like, that's what we want to do. And the only way to do that is to actually have financial resources.
We're talking with producer Effie Brown about her new job at Game Changer. So much of what you're saying reminds me about what happened on Project Greenlight.
Ah.
This is the documentary series that you're a part of, and there was a conversation around diversity with Matt Damon, and Matt Damon said,
when we're talking about diversity, you do it in the casting of the film, not in the casting of the show.
Whew. Wow, okay.
Do you want to,
when you're back here 4 years ago, this is what you said about changing that conversation.
I really do hope that people stop talking about it and be about it. That's what I hope. I hope that this forces people to examine their own blind spots, even though they feel they are liberal 101, be like power to the people, because a lot of times in practice, it's not something that is done.
So I think we will
Word.
Agree.
There you go.
Hollywood loves to see itself as
Stop
liberal
it.
And progressive, but when it comes to making some hiring decisions and financing, it isn't. So how do you change the mindset of the people making decisions?
You know, I think part of that goes back to what I said before, is that when we're coming to them in a different way of actually being someone that has skin in the game, money behind it, and to be sort of like the masters of our own destiny, it's a different conversation than going there with a project and please, please finance me, please, please take my movie, please, to be able to say, okay, look, we already have something already. We can do this on our own, or we can find a partner. I'm not asking you for everything. I actually can step up to the table as well. So I think that, and also, I mean, as we know, this is show business, not show charity. And this time when people are pitching, you know, with Game Changer, you're pitching to people that are of that community. Like, you can't make something about us without us, you know?
Do you think the nature of that conversation has changed?
I want to say, what has changed since the last time I've come in here is that people have realized that inclusivity is good business, right? That like, oh, you guys show up to the movies? You guys over-index here? You're good business. But then it gets to, and this is where I may get into a little bit of trouble, it's a whole thing of like, well, who gets to tell whose stories? There's so many things that I can point to where it's a subject matter that the director is not of that community, the producer is not of that community, but they're banking on this inclusivity thing. And then for me, I find that it becomes less authentic. So this way, I think there's a way to challenge that.
When you start thinking about the kinds of movies that Game Changer is going to make, it feels like it was narrowly defined once to be about women. How are you expanding the mandate?
Probably the better way for us to say it is this. I'm going to tell you what we're not going to be into. We're not going to be normalizing black poverty porn. Not into that. I'm not going to be doing the LGBTQ story where it's tragic. there's more than that. We're not going to do the person who is disabled who actually doesn't have a disability, you know, in the lead role. And I think that we're also going to be doing movies where they're actually shown as complicated, fully realized people. So those are the things that we are not and that we are going to do. We're doing things that are cutting edge. I want to do stuff that you haven't seen before. We're going to be taking a chance. And that's really important to us. And we're also going to be doing it in a culturally and gender-specific sort of way. So bring it.
Effie Brown is a veteran producer. She's just been named CEO of the Film Fund Game Changer. Effie, great to see you. Thanks for
coming.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And that'll do it for today. But don't forget to tune in for The Frame Weekend. You can hear it Saturday afternoon at 2. The show is produced by Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzi Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez and Donald Paz are our engineers. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn. We're off on Monday for the MLK holiday, but back here on Tuesday from the Moon Broadcast Center. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.